Welcome to the Security Nexus Deep Dive. We're brought to you by the Security Nexus, a Maryland-based national security consultancy. Our whole mission here is to inform, educate, and empower people, professionals, the public, everyone with clear, actionable knowledge. We cover strategic security policy, cyber threats, hybrid warfare, you name it. Today, we're diving deep, literally, into the hidden world beneath the waves, the world of subsea cables. You know, when we think about the internet, we often talk about the cloud. It sounds so ethereal, doesn't it? But the reality is much more physical. Almost all of it, I mean, nearly everything, relies on this vast, intricate network of actual cables running along the ocean floor. And these aren't just for, you know, streaming movies. They're the absolute bedrock for global finance, cloud computing, even critical military command and control.
That's exactly right. These cables, they carry something like over 99% of all transoceanic digital communication. Think about that. Trillions of dollars in financial transactions every single day. And they're fundamental for everything that's coming next, 5G, the Internet of Things, AI. All of it relies on this infrastructure. Yet despite being so incredibly important, they often remain, well, invisible. As Christian Boyger and Tobias Liebertraut point out, even policymakers sometimes overlook them.
So our mission today is to really unpack these choke points in the digital ocean. We're going to explore the threats, things like accidental cable cuts, ship anchors, natural disasters, even covert tapping and sabotage. And then we'll look at what can actually be done about it. Deterrence options, redundancy. How do we secure these vital lifelines? We're drawing on some great research today, including work by M.A. Claire and colleagues on climate impacts, Xianbo Xiang and Qin Zhang on AUV tracking, and further analysis from Christian Boyger, Tobias Liebertraut, Esther Mwema, and Ni Quainor. The invisible lifelines. Why subsea cables are critical. Okay, let's start at the beginning. What exactly are these cables and why are they so critical, even if we, you know, never lay eyes on them?
Well, fundamentally, a modern subsea cable, the kind you find in the deep ocean, is basically a tube. This polyethylene, maybe 17 to 21 millimeters across. Inside that tube, you've got a steel member for strength, a copper line to carry power, and then the really crucial bit, the optical glass fibers that transmit the data using light pulses. Now, in shallower waters, closer to land, say less than 2,000 meters deep, they need more protection. So they're bigger, maybe up to 50 millimeters, and they've got layers of steel wire armor wrapped around them. And because the light signal fades over distance, they need repeaters, like amplifiers, spaced roughly every 70 to 100 kilometers along the cable. These repeaters get their power through that copper line, fed by direct current generators at the landing stations back on shore.
Wow, so not just simple wires at all. These are really sophisticated pieces of engineering, aren't they? Like hidden arteries on the seabed. And that invisibility you mentioned, that's a really key factor here.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's what Boyger and Liebertraut call this triple invisibility. Think about it. Their infrastructure, which people often take for granted, they're buried in the ground at the landing points. And of course, they're deep in the sea. So historically, they just haven't gotten much public attention or even detailed analytical focus from policymakers, despite, you know, carrying 99% of our global data.
It kind of echoes history too, doesn't it? Secure communication lines have always been vital.
Precisely. I mean, go back to the first transatlantic telegraph cable that was laid in 1866, largely financed by an American businessman, Cyrus Field West. And its military importance was obvious pretty quickly. It's similar to how the internet's precursor, ARPANET, was initially a U.S. Department of Defense project during the Cold War. And interestingly, as Esther Mwema and Ni Quainor point out, many of the routes laid down back in the telegraph era are actually quite similar to the paths today's fiber optic cables follow. Two, threats from the deep. Natural hazards.
Okay, so they're critical, they're hidden, which makes you think, what kind of dangers do they face down there? And maybe surprisingly, the biggest initial threat isn't human, it's nature itself.
That's right. Subsea cables are incredibly vulnerable to natural disasters. We're talking earthquakes shaking the seabed, volcanic eruptions, like that huge eruption in Tonga and the Tonga Hapai volcano back in January 2022. It severed the only international cable connecting Tonga. Imagine communications cut off right when disaster relief was most critical.
A single point of failure. Wow.
Exactly. And then you have tsunamis, underwater landslides, which can be massive, and even icebergs scouring the seabed in Arctic regions.
And climate change is playing a role here, too, isn't it? It's not just an environmental issue. It's acting as a sort of threat multiplier for the cables.
It absolutely is.
Whoa.
M.A. Claire and colleagues did a global review that really drives this home. For example, they point to research showing that potentially thousands of kilometers of onshore cable infrastructure in the U.S., stuff never designed to be underwater, might actually be submerged by sea level rise as soon as 2030.
Onshore cable. Submerged.
Yeah, near the coastlines where the cables come ashore. And think about storm surges. They can raise coastal water levels by several meters. Right now, about 4% of global cable landing stations are vulnerable to a major 1-in-100-year storm event. That could rise to 7% by the end of the century under high-emission scenarios. Hurricane Maria is a real-world example. It caused direct flood damage to a landing station in Puerto Rico. They had to shut down power to protect the equipment.
That's a direct hit. What about the forces under the water that climate change might be amplifying?
Well, take river flooding. More intense rainstorms mean rivers dump massive amounts of sediment into the ocean. This can trigger powerful underwater avalanches called turbidity currents. These things can travel hundreds, even thousands of kilometers and just slice through cables in their path. We saw this in 2009 after Typhoon Morakot offshore Taiwan. 9 cable faults, one after another. And in 2020, a flood in the Congo River Canyon triggered a turbidity current that traveled over 1,000 kilometers down the submarine canyon, breaking multiple cables connecting West and South Africa.
Incredible destructive power.
It really is.
Yeah.
And even deep water currents, potentially intensified by changing ocean patterns, can scour the seabed and abrade cables over time. The Cantat 3 cable off Iceland experienced faults attributed to strong deep currents. So yeah, our digital world is far more tied to the planet's physical systems, and the risks are increasing and shifting geographically. 3, human threats, accidental and malicious.
Okay, so nature is a major force, but humans are also a big part of the threat picture, right? Both accidentally and sometimes deliberately.
Yes, and interestingly, accidental damage is actually the most frequent cause of cable faults. We're talking maybe 200 to 300 incidents every year globally. The main culprits: fishing gear, especially bottom trawling, and ship anchors.
Anchors and fishing nets.
Exactly. Certain types of trawls, like scallop dredges, can dig into the seabed. If a cable isn't buried deep enough, it's vulnerable. Even large anchors just sitting on the bottom, if used with certain types of nets, have damaged well-buried cables off China, for instance. And anchor dragging, where a ship drops anchor and scrapes along the bottom, that's a very common cause of cable breaks.
Okay, so accidents happen. But then there are the deliberate threats. The ones that are, well, more worrying from a security perspective.
Yes, malicious acts have a serious concern for national security. There are documented cases. For instance, back in 2013, divers deliberately cut the Simi to Lipi-4 cable near Alexandria, Egypt. Internet speeds in the country dropped by something like 60%.
60% just from one cut?
In that specific case, yes. It highlights vulnerability. There was also a strange incident in Vietnam where fishermen misunderstood a government plan about salvaging old copper cables and ended up, well, salvaging almost all of the country's fiber optic links by mistake. More recently, and perhaps more strategically concerning, China was suspected of intentionally cutting 2 cables connecting Taiwan to one of its offshore island groups in early 2023. That resulted in a 50-day internet outage for those islands. And beyond physical cuts, there's the threat of covert tapping. Espionage.
Listening in on the data.
Precisely. It's not new. Reports suggest the U.S. tapped a Soviet military cable back in the 1970s. And as recently as 2015, documents indicated the U.S. intelligence community had arrangements to access data flowing through certain cables owned by American companies like AT&T. Certain locations, choke points like the Suez Canal, where many cables converge, are naturally attractive spots for this kind of activity.
But isn't most data encrypted now?
A lot is, yes. But not everything. Metadata often isn't fully encrypted, many emails still travel unencrypted, and then there's the future threat. The concern is that data harvested now could potentially be decrypted later using future technologies, like quantum computing.
Which brings us to hybrid warfare and maybe even terrorism.
It's exactly. There's growing concern, especially since around 2015, about observed Russian submarine activity near known cable routes. This raises fears about potential espionage, or worse, preparations for sabotage and a crisis. Analysts like Schaub and others are now that in any kind of hybrid warfare campaign, these cables would be, quote, prime targets.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just states. The locations of many cables are public knowledge. The technical skill needed to damage a cable, especially in shallower water, isn't necessarily that high. So non-state actors, terrorist groups, could potentially target them. The U.S. State Department even noted this vulnerability back in 2010. 4. Digital sovereignty and geopolitical battlegrounds.
This is fascinating. It really highlights how these physical cables aren't just passive infrastructure. They're becoming actual battlegrounds for what people are calling digital sovereignty, geopolitics playing out on the seabed.
That's a great way to put it. Digital sovereignty is basically a nation's ability to control what happens with cables in its territory or connecting to it. Can it dictate routes, set standards, ensure protection, safeguard the data flowing through. But it's really complicated because these cables are inherently transnational. They cross borders, connect continents, and crucially, a lot of them are now privately owned.
Right. That ownership question is key. Who does own these critical global arteries?
Well, historically, it was often consortia of telecom companies, many state-owned or with strong government ties. But there's been a huge shift. By the end of 2020, estimates suggest around 59% of subsea cable capacity was owned entirely by private companies. And we're talking mainly the hyperscalers, Google, Meta, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, even companies like Huawei.
The big tech giants.
Exactly. They have the resources to fund and build entire cable systems themselves. This gives them enormous influence over the global communication network. And it can create power imbalances. Rafael Garcia Perez notes how countries in the global south often become dependent on these global north tech companies for their basic connectivity. Mwema and colleagues specifically point out how Google and Meta are building cables that encircle Africa, often using proprietary contracts that limit public oversight.
So, faced with this private dominance and the strategic importance, how are nations trying to assert more control? What strategies are they using?
We're seeing roughly three main approaches emerging. First is infrastructure regulation and blacklisting. Under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS, specifically Article 21, coastal states can set rules for laying cables within their territorial waters. They can control who builds or owns infrastructure there. Some countries, like New Zealand, Australia, Uruguay, Colombia, they've passed specific laws creating cable protection zones, where activities like anchoring and fishing are restricted.
But is this widely adopted?
Not uniformly. A researcher named Matley points out there's often an implementation gap. Many countries have the right under UNCLOS, but haven't actually passed the necessary national laws or enforced them effectively. The second strategy is simply building their own cables.
Taking matters into their own hands.
Right. Investing in national or regionally controlled cables to bypass potentially adversarial countries or routes considered vulnerable to tapping. For example, the EU is looking into a new cable route across the Black Sea, connecting Georgia to Eastern Europe, partly to reduce reliance on infrastructure that might cross Russian territory. And China's Digital Silk Road Initiative, as highlighted by Shen, explicitly includes expanding its own global submarine cable network as a strategic goal. Look at Egypt, too. Telecom Egypt, which is 70% government-owned, has partial ownership in a huge percentage, maybe 80% or more, of the cables running through that critical Suez Canal-Red Sea corridor.
Yeah.
That gives them significant influence. And the third strategy, which ties into resilience, is diversification and redundancy.
Meaning, don't put all your eggs in one basket or one cable route.
Exactly. Having multiple cables connecting key points and making sure those cables take different physical paths. Egypt, again, has duplicated routes for most of its Mediterranean cables. So if one is cut, traffic can ideally be rerouted onto another. This is absolutely vital. We saw with Tonga how devastating a single cable cut can be for a country with no redundancy. The goal is to build a network that can withstand faults without causing widespread outages, V-deterrence and redundancy options, securing the digital ocean.
Okay, so we understand the threats, natural, accidental, deliberate, and the geopolitical maneuvering. What are the concrete options for actually securing these cables? What does deterrence and redundancy look like in practice?
Well, it really has to be a multi-layered approach. There's no single silver bullet. First, there's basic physical protection. In shallower waters, as we mentioned, cables are often armored and buried, sometimes a meter or two deep under the seabed. M.A. Clare mentions burial down to 2,000 meters depth in some areas like the Northeast Atlantic. But, you know, there are about 1.4 million kilometers of subsea cable worldwide. Burying all of that, especially in the deep ocean, is just astronomically expensive. It's not feasible for the whole network.
Right. So if you can't armor everything, you need to watch it closely. Surveillance becomes key.
Exactly. Monitoring and surveillance technology is where a lot of innovation is happening. Things like autonomous underwater vehicles, AUVs, and unmanned underwater gliders, UUGs. These robots can patrol cable routes, inspect them, look for damage or suspicious activity. Research by Xianbo Shang and Qin Zhang, for instance, shows how AUVs can use sophisticated magnetic sensors to track cables very effectively, even filtering out background noise from ocean currents or the vehicle itself. You can even have resident AUVs that stay deployed in a specific sensitive area for months at a time, providing persistent monitoring.
Underwater guards, basically.
Sort of, yeah. And they work alongside a whole suite of specialized sensors. You can use acoustic sensors, like ADCPs, to detect disturbances in the water column caused by digging or anchors. Turbidity sensors pick up sediment kicked up from the seabed. Magnetometers towed behind surface vessels or mounted on AUVs can detect large metallic objects, like a lost anchor, from quite a distance. High-resolution sonar systems, multi-beam, side-scan, synthetic aperture sonar can map the seabed in detail and spot things like anchor drag marks or fishing gear. In shallower, critical areas like near landing stations or choke points, you might deploy diver detection sonars, EDS. And even underwater cameras can be useful in very shallow water, maybe mounted on mooring lines. Some research even looks at using standard oceanographic sensors, measuring pH, temperature, salinity, as subtle changes could potentially indicate the presence of a submarine nearby trying to be stealthy.
That's quite a technological toolkit, making the invisible seabed a bit more visible, a bit more monitored. But detection alone isn't enough, right? You mentioned redundancy earlier. How does that fit in?
It's absolutely crucial. Redundancy and diversification are about building inherent resilience into the network itself. It means having multiple cable paths between important locations. If one cable gets cut, whether by an anchor or sabotage, the traffic can automatically be rerouted onto other cables. Many modern cable systems are actually designed with built-in spare capacity, maybe 15-30% buffer, specifically to handle this kind of rerouting. So efforts like Egypt duplicating its Mediterranean routes or tech companies building multiple transatlantic cables are all part of this strategy. And finally, addressing the espionage threat requires robust data encryption.
Protecting the information itself.
Right. Pushing for wider adoption of secure protocols like HTTPS for all websites, encouraging end-to-end encryption for messaging and communications platforms, and looking ahead, especially for sensitive government or military communications, investing in and deploying quantum-safe encryption methods is becoming critical. These are algorithms designed to resist decryption attempts, even by future powerful quantum computers.
Wow. We have really gone deep today into this hidden world beneath the waves. It's absolutely clear that these subsea cables, these invisible lifelines, are not just amazing feats of technology. They're also incredibly vulnerable, they're geopolitically charged, and they are utterly essential to almost everything we do in modern life.
Precisely. And I think the key takeaway is that no single country, no single company can secure this global network alone. The threats are too varied. You've got unpredictable natural disasters made worse by climate change. You've got accidental damage from everyday activities. And you've got deliberate malicious acts of sabotage and espionage. So ensuring the resilience of our digital future really requires a holistic approach. It needs engineering solutions, yes, but also cooperation on policy, understanding the socioeconomic factors, integrating natural science insights, and crucially, international collaboration.
It leaves you with a pretty powerful thought, doesn't it? This hidden, fragile infrastructure. What does its vulnerability tell us about the true nature of our global interconnectedness and about our shared vulnerabilities, both to the forces of nature and, well, to ourselves? What responsibility do we all have to understand this hidden world and work towards protecting it? For more deep dives and strategic insights into cyber threats, hybrid warfare, national security policy, and all these interconnected issues, please do visit us at thesecuritynexus.net. Join us next time for another deep dive.